taping now. Today is April 30th, and we're learning the very end of Sefer Daniel, where Daniel had expressed to God what was a natural result of the two different dates that Yirmiyahu gave for how long they should wait 70 years. Mm-hmm. Those two dates are about 20 years apart from when they start, one from the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, one from the destruction of the temple. You can't know when to end something if you don't know when to begin it. So Yirmiyahu, whose 70-year prediction was known to Daniel and to others, but they apparently, as Daniel is expressing here, were not clear about when it's supposed to end. The response that Hashem gives to Yirmiyahu is extremely cryptic and has been understood by Rashi and many others to refer not just to his time, but to a future time. And that it's even possible that by interpreting the weeks that he mentions to wait as not 7 days, but 7 years, or the days that Hashem tells him to wait, not as a year, a day, but a year. It's the same thing. A year is a day, a week is 7 years. So in all of these instances, it's very possible that the purpose of the cryptic nature of the end of Daniel is to simultaneously, ingeniously, give us two separate reckonings of a redemption simultaneously. You see that while these can refer to where the 70-year exile will end, that's would appear to be the simple pshat of the story. If Daniel expresses confusion about when the Jews will finally return back to Israel after this Babylonian exile, and God gives him a very long, and by our reckoning, must say, convoluted description of how much longer we need to wait, right? And God says, now hide these things, right? It would appear that the purpose of hiding these things is for the distant future. What would the purpose of hiding something that's about to end in 5, 10, or 12, or 13 years? Right? Usually, over the years, when someone made a prediction based on biblical prophecies for when the Mashiach should come, usually it was some safe time when I don't expect to be alive anymore, where I'll have to answer to my mistake. Right? But I want to prepare the world for it. Right? The Talmud warns us precisely against this kind of thing, because history shows us that whenever we did this, and the date came and went, and nothing happened to us while we were waiting in this long, bitter exile, that it led to widespread depression and even shmat, even mass conversion. Right? There are some famous dates. I gave you, I believe, last week some of those Hashbon note. And today I'm adding a chiddush from last week, is that while we mentioned all the commentaries who say that what appears here at the end of Daniel, in the simple meaning of the text, is just God telling Daniel how much longer to wait in your lifetime before it's time to go back to Israel. Another few years, right? That there are other commentaries who say that what Daniel is talking about is something that hasn't happened yet. We're still waiting for it to happen. So the chiddush I'm suggesting to you now is that Daniel is sufficiently nebulous as to possibly suffer both of those interpretations. And if you can imagine such a thing. Can you? Okay. Because that's why I'm suggesting that he uses these unusual terminologies. Because if he's just telling us to wait 1,290 days and another 1,335 days, right? That's that long past. Long, long past. Right? So in our case also, the same problem we have with Yirmiyahu of how to know when to end something is dependent on when to start it. We have the same problem in Yirmiyahu. So let's read. Right? It says, but it's just we're going to read the last three psukim. Umeis husar hatamid veloseis shikutz shomein. From the time that the Tamid, that's a very clear clearly defined event, right?
Except
the time
happened,
it happened five times. And when the tamid, what does it say, the daily sacrifice? Or did you just say tamid? Right? From the time the daily offering, right, was removed. Okay. We have to look in history and see how many times was the tamid, the daily offering, came to a cessation. How many times did that happen? Right? But however he gives a description, v'loseis shikutz shomem. Shikutz means a despicable thing attached to it. Yomim elef masayim v'tishim. Count 1,290 days. Ashrei ha-machakeh v'yagia liyomim elef shlosh meot shloshim v'chamisha. And strides or jubilation or validation to the one who can wait 1,335 days. Now this is a matter of a couple of years, right? V'ato, Daniel, leich l'keitz v'tanoch v'tamod d'gorocha l'keitz yamin. Now, Daniel, go to your destiny. You see, it says Keitz Hayomin for the Nun. Mm-hmm. Right? Nun is the ending, the masculine ending in Aramaic. But there are quite a few such cases. Chitin instead of Chitim, Bachayin and Yov instead of Bachayim. There are quite a few. Keitz Yomin means that like Acharit Hayomim, the end of days. Those last two words is why we have a temptation to say that Daniel is talking about the distant future, something we haven't seen yet. In fact, you're familiar with in the 13 stanza song called Yigdal that we sing to describe the 13 principles of faith. Right? So the last one is Yishlach Leketz Hayamin Meshichenu Lufos Machaki Ketz Yeshua. So, feel carefully, he takes these words. Yishlach Leketz Hayamin. Some darshan something about the right hand, but it's clear, it's the same as Yomim with a mem. So here's what we need to do. We have to figure out how long we're supposed to count, and then figure out where we started from. So, is it 1,290 days and 1,335 days? Okay, that's long past us. That's 2,500 years ago. I don't remember anything, unless it was just on that day, if you would have counted from this prophecy, 1,290 days and another 1,335 days, right? Right? It's about 2,700 days. Right? Okay, 2,600 days. Precisely 2,625. That is, 6-7 years. Okay? So, seven or eight years. So, that's not much time. And then that day may have coincided with the day that Ezra brought all the people back to Israel. Okay? Goodbye. Daniel has nothing to tell us. In terms of what we're expecting now. Daniel is in the past. It's finished. Right. However, such an important book as this, can't just go by and not have something to teach us now. You can be sure of this. Christians take all of these writing here and say that this refers to the entry of Jesus into Jerusalem. The problem with that is it's either you say that it's right at Daniel's time, shortly afterwards, to reconcile between the two different 70-year exile descriptions, or it's in the distant future. But to put it 600 so years, for 500 years from then, it's just nitahin nitahir. It's not here nor there. It's really quite faulty to say such a thing, because it's either 7 or 8 years, or it's 2,700 years. Right? You can't have it someplace in the middle. It's either 2,700 days or 2,700 years. Okay? Alright, So, the question is, when do we start this count? Right? So he says the time that the Tamid stopped. The Tumid stopped 5 times in our history. I think we discussed this already. I'll just remind you now. It stops once in the reign of Ataliah. Ataliah is first, right? Once in the reign of Achaz, described in the Prophet. Once when the temple was destroyed. Once in the Hanukkah story, and once the temple was destroyed again. I'm going to write those dates on the board. But I'm going to have to give some rounded off dates, because we can't give specific times, because it doesn't say in the Bible. About this years from creation, that would be in 3050.
That's Ataliah.
That's Ataliah. The date of Achaz would be... approximately... 3180, 130 years after that. Okay. The temple was destroyed in approximation 3330. Okay. This is Ataliah. Achaz. This is temple one. This would be the Hanukkah story. Just before the Hanukkah story, there was also a cessation of the Tumid. Right. And I have to, let's just give the nice shiny it would be. Let's call it 3820. These are rounded off dates. Okay. 3620. Okay. I have 5 dates. Approximate times. To count our years. Right? Okay? These are years from creation. Okay? And we are now in the year 3773. Now, God was telling Daniel to count from a specific time, a certain amount of days. Which of these 5 would make the most sense? Ataliah, Achaz, first destruction, Hanukkah, second destruction. That's what the Malbim decided. Tell me why you think so.
Because of the time during his lifetime.
I thought it was a long time before that.
But what happened before? So that he
knew that. I think the one right before when he's talking. The last one. Mm-hmm. Right, but that should have driven you to a different conclusion. The first Chorban. He lived through it. He experienced it. Mm-hmm. How do I know? Because it says in the beginning of his book, he was carried off into the exile of the Yehoyachin. 11 years later, the temple was destroyed. Okay, he must be much older by now, right? Daniel, at the time he's saying this, he's got to be in his 80s, 90s. Because if he remembered being carried off in the exile, let's say as a young child, right? It doesn't say he was given prophecy yet, but it says shortly afterwards he was called upon by the king Nebuchadnezzar to stand in his presence. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't have been such a child, maybe 18, 20, right? He's a young, strapping, brilliant young man, okay? So if he's 20 then this is 50, 60 years later. He's an old man. I'm fine. That's fine. But if he was going to give a landmark time for when to start counting his 1290, 1335, it should be as close as possible to his own time, no? Wouldn't you think? Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Which would be the first temple, the one in parentheses. Right. So the Malbim says, yeah, but the problem with that is that if you add these dates to 3330, 1290, and 1325, then you're getting much, much too late in history. It's happening too far from now. You don't want to give it a messianic prediction. That is 200 years from now. You want to give one that's, you know, a little closer than that. 60 years, 50 years. You don't want to give something too far away, because then your readers are not going to think that that's attainable for them. Right? So, you give your preferable interpretation, but there's one other thing, I mentioned it before, that we must contend with. He calls the cessation of the offering, the daily offering, a despicable, disgusting thing. Remember, what's the English translation? Shikutz Shomei. What does he call it there? 11, maybe? Shikutz Shomei. What's that? What is it called? Abomination?
Mute abomination.
Okay. The mute abomination. Okay. Shomei means like astonishing abomination. Would be maybe better. Mm-hmm. Remember what word Rashi says comes from this word? Shomayim. Shomayim. He says, so Shomayim is an astonishment. You look up at the Shomayim, you should be astonished. So he says that's where the word Shomayim comes from. Shomayim. Right? Shmama. Which has taken on to mean many other things in Hebrew, like the Shmama is a desolation. Anyway, the Shikut Shomayim, he says, does not describe by this destruction of the temple. Nebuchadnezzar didn't make the temple to be an abominable place. He made it to be a destroyed place. Right? So, if I were to choose which one of these five became a Shikutz Shomeim, I would say the Hanukkah story.
That's what I said.
Right? Because that was Shikutz Shomeim. They were offering pigs on the altar. They were offering people on the altar. That became, the altar of God became a despicable, abominable thing in the Hanukkah story. But the Malbim didn't want that one either, because that would really put us far, far away. If we're going to start counting all these years from 3620, that's 500 years away. Right? So there's not much left. By Isheni, I can't say, maybe the Romans did make, but they also just swiftly destroyed it. They didn't make it into a Shikutz Shomeim. And that leaves us Atalia and Achaz. Mm-hmm. Atalia didn't do it. She just put a stop to it. She just says, oh, this temple doesn't deserve to be worked, and she made them stop. Right? Achaz, now we're talking. Achaz did make the temple to be a Shikutz Shomeim. It says in Tanakh that it was amazing because he had a great father. His father was Yotam. His son was Chizkiyahu. Basically, Yotam is great, Achaz terrible. Chizkiyahu great, Menashe terrible. Menashe had another son who was terrible, Amon. And his son, Yoshiyahu, was great. So it was like it's like when you go bowling and you score a strike and then you leave a frame open and another strike and you leave a frame open and another strike and you leave a frame open. You can't score a good game that way, because you have to put a couple of strikes together in order to get a good game. So you have to have two or three good kings together in order to bring back Israel to its previous grandeur. But they keep having keeps on staggering between good and bad and good and bad. So Achaz was terrible. He sent his high priest to Aram to make plans for their Beis HaMikdash, and they cleared out our temple and made our temple look like theirs. Thank God he had a good son, Chizkiyahu, who fixed that up, but still, he made the temple to be a Shikutz Shomeim. Right? Why were you thinking Achaz? Because you felt that was the last one? So that the Chorban was between them.
My chronology is not so
great. Alright, so... But that's the one that the Malbim considered was the... He says that Shikutz Shomeim fits two of these, the Hanukkah story and Achaz. But the Hanukkah story is also defies logic. Why would Hashem tell Daniel to start counting from something that hasn't happened yet? All right, it's possible. You know, but why give a landmark for something that hasn't happened yet? Surely he should give a landmark for something that has happened. Okay.
Well, he
so,
kind of foretold it, right? Didn't he kind of foretell?
That's Zechariah.
Oh.
That's Zechariah. Okay, but still, it's a colleague of his. Okay. Oh. Zechariah's description of the Hanukkah story is the Haftorah that we read on Shabbos Hanukkah. About the menorah with its everlasting oil and the assimilation and the battle with few to defeat the many. It's all from Zechariah. So, but what the Malbim did was that he showed that if you count the amount of years that he tells you to count, assuming that the word day means year, then you get to 1915. Right? You get to the year 1915. And he predicted that in 1915, there would be a great war. And he did it. This prediction was made in the 1860s. And he claimed that Germany would be at the forefront of the war. Not just because he saw that the Kaiser was, that Germany was already, you know, preparing for such a thing already so early, but because the battle to fight this battle was called by Daniel's contemporary and colleague Yechezkel, which we learned last year, the year before, that Daniel's contemporary Yechezkel said this war would be fought by a king of Magog. Right, so the fact that you were so familiar with the fact that it's
Gog, Melech Magog.
Right, Gog, Melech Magog. The words Gog and Magog never appear in the Bible.
So where did it come from?
Where did it come from? It appears often in the Talmud. It's all over the Talmud. Gemara refers to the final battle, which Christians erroneously call Armageddon. I'll tell you why in a moment. This final battle is never called Gog Umagog. It's just one nation. Gog Melech Magog. Now, the Magog is Germany, according to Yechezkel, according to the Malbim. Why? Because Magog was he and Ashkenaz were brothers. So Ashkenaz is Germany, and Magog is the same family as Ashkenaz. So he felt that Ashkenaz was the ancient name of Germany, and Magog is the modern name of Germany. And then they worked with all kinds of gematrias and whatnot. But you see herein lies the issue. The gematria of Gog Umagog is 70. Mm. 70 represents an important number in biblical terminologies. It's
life of the person.
What?
70 is like the life of the person.
It's Ayin Umot HaOlam. There's 70 nations in the world. In fact, if you look at all the nations that are mentioned in Parshas Noach, that spread out to the... To
70?
There's 70. The Stone Chumash gives you all 70 in the beginning. Maybe this one does too. In the Stone Chumash, it's in the beginning. There it might be all the way at the end. But anyway, the reason why that it says Gog Magog according to the Malbim is because you're... So he says that a world war doesn't necessarily involve every single nation in the world. I don't think there's anyone here old enough to remember, but World War I started because this country fought that country, and that country was at a peace pact with another country. Said, "Okay, if you fight him, you fight me." So Russia entered, and then Germany went into Belgium to get to France, and then England said, "Well, we're allies with Belgium. So if you fight Belgium, you're fighting us." And every country after country started getting involved until it became a world war, right? So it doesn't mean that every country in the world was involved, but it does mean that every country has a stake in the war. You might be able to sit out and be neutral, but you do have an interest in this war, right? You know, if Great Britain and the Falklands have a skirmish, does that mean that New Zealand has an interest? Maybe. But a world war is where everybody in the world has an interest in this war. How this war ends will affect us. And that's what the Malbim claimed Mohammed's Gog and Magog would be. Started in 1915, involving Germany. The problem is that the war that Yechezkel talks about involves the Jewish people. And insofar as World War I certainly did not involve the Jewish people per se, but World War II did, so I might answer for the Malbim that World War II was actually a continuation of World War I. The way World War I ended almost guaranteed that there would be another war. So, and that war had Jews at its central focus. And therefore, the Malbim might be able to be used, based on this prophecy at the end of Daniel, to prove that World War II was Mohammed's Gog and Magog, and we are living in its future. What's my advantage for this? Because the way the Bible and the rabbis speak of Mohammed's Gog and Magog, I'd rather it be in our past. Right? because if that wasn't Gog and Magog, what could be Chas v'Shalom? It's in our past. Chemes Gog and Magog, where, by the way, Zechariah says it will wipe out 2/3 of our people. Now, it didn't wipe out 2/3 of all the people. It wiped out 2/3 of the Jewish people of Europe, right? And he says that 2/3 be Shnayim this, and the remaining third will go back to Israel. That's what these books are about. I told you that the Christians mistakenly called this war Armageddon, because when Zechariah refers to this battle, he talks about a past event where the Jews cried at Har Megiddon. And it is a very cryptic verse. In fact, the Gemara at the beginning of Megillah says we wouldn't know what this verse even means if not for the Targum. So the Targum refers to a battle fought at Har Megiddo, not Megiddon. Right? But he's just calling it Megiddon as his expression of it, where the king of Israel, Yoshiyahu, was killed. And the Jews mourned that fall, and they cried at Har Megiddon. They cried because of what happened at Har Megiddon. So the Christians took the prophecy for whatever they say it means and said it's Har Armageddon. It should really be Harmageddon, first of all, right? But that's not even talking about a futuristic battle. It's talking about a battle where Yoshiyahu was killed, right? But that's the dogma, and that's why they call it that, right? So Daniel is used by many people to give these time periods. If I were to judge, the problem is Shikut Shomeim might not fit the destruction of the first temple. If the Babylonians went in and looted and made mockery, then maybe you want to say that the first temple was also a Shikut Shomeim. And that would be preferable, because if we count these years from here, right, when we get to 59-55, right? So that's pretty far from now, isn't it? But not if you remember what I taught 2 weeks ago. Remember what we spoke about? 164 missing years? Remember this? Zaira DeRossi, and we made the chart of it 2 weeks ago. That means that we're not in 57-73, we're actually in 59-37.
We're that close.
All right, wait a second. Pretty close. Eat your Wheaties. Alright, let's get there. We'll all be 18 years, we'll all be here. We'll have a party here in this room, remembering this year, when we're all ready to grab the boat to Yerushalayim. Anyway, the Malvin.
Me? A plane.
Yeshayahu says, when it's time for Jews to go back to Israel, I will dry up the waters like I did when you left Egypt and had to walk through the Red Sea. You'll be able to, because Sheol likes to compare the future return to Israel to the first return to Israel. So he may be referring to plane travel. He won't have to get into a vessel that goes into the water like you had to until... that's how my father came to America in the 40s, on a boat. Right? Okay, this is a new way to get back to Israel without getting your feet wet. So,
people will be very disappointed if it doesn't happen.
No. Yeah, of course. So
your father got to Israel while the war had started already. Then.
No, my father came to America in 1949.
41.
49. 49.
Oh, afterwards.
After the war. Yeah. So here, the Malbim, after writing all of this, it's a very lengthy discussion at the end of Daniel. He says, I know the Talmud says that you're not supposed to give a reckoning for the Messianic age. Now, the Ramban gave the same explanation in the year 51, for the year 5100. That's at least 600 some odd years ago, right? He predicted 5100 based on the following cheshbon. And the Vilna Gaon predicted 1840. That was a big one, 1840, for the coming of Mashiach. But the Ramban predicted 5100 because he considered every 1,000 years of human existence since the time, in his cheshbon, he wasn't getting into the whole theories of how old the world is, but he said, from Adam Arishon, the way the Bible counts the years, right? That's we have our cheshbonos from the beginning of Bereshis. Avram is born in the year 1948, Yitzchak is born in 2048, Yaakov is born in 2108, we left Egypt, you know, all these cheshbonos that we get from the Bible. So he says that we can see a 6,000-year history unfolding, where every 1,000 years corresponds to a day of creation. Listen to this, it's really quite fascinating. He says that the first day of creation was very, very, everything was a soupy mess. The first 1,000 years of history was messed up. And you know what? So was the second 1,000 years. Because God didn't give form to the earth until Tashay Aretz Deshe, until the third day. The beginning of the third day would correspond to the year 2000, right? The beginning of 2001. Well, that's why the Ramban claims that Avram was 52 when he found God. The Rambam says 48, but the Ramban claims 52 because Avram turns 52 in the year 2000. The spreading of vegetation around the world is like Avram spreading the word of one of a single God. Right? And the spreading of vegetation works very well. It spreads beautifully around the world, and then we create the two luminaries. Because just in the beginning of the third 1,000 year is the building of the Beis HaMikdash. That's the luminary that sheds light on the whole world. But alas, it was also destroyed in that 1,000 year period. In fact, it was destroyed twice in that 1,000 year period. And that's evident of the moon getting smaller. Right? It waxes and it wanes. And the fourth day of creation, as well as the fifth day of creation, which would start in the year 240, right, was the worst of all the days. Because that's where the animals alone prowl the earth. He says from the year 240 to 1240 was the worst single millennia of the history of the world. He says so for obvious reasons, because the temple was just destroyed. And, you know, Christians and Muslims, are, at least for us, it's the worst 1,000 year period. With just a black splotch of history. And he says in the year 1240 represents the sixth day of creation. And the sixth day of creation, animals were also created. But then man came. So he scoured rabbinic literature to say, at what hour of the day was man created? Because if the creation of the world is the unfolding of history, the creation of man should be the coming of Mashiach. And he saw in the Talmud that man was created in the first tenth of the day. There you go, 5100. What's 6,000? What happens in 6,000? Shabbos. Yom Shikulu Shabbos. And the Pasuk Asher Bara Elokim La'asof, take a look at the Ramban, it says all of this. So that's where he predicted the coming of Mashiach in the year 5100. Nebuch. It came and went. Nothing happened. 5100 would be the year 1340. Right? The Vilna Gaon predicted 1840. He had a different cheshbon of the creation of man also. He found a different medrash that's a lot of creation, a lot of messianic arrivals is with the year 40 at the end. So the Malbim, as well as the Ramban, said they compared it to a parable about a man who's traveling for a long, long journey with his son. And shortly after they leave, the son pulls on the driver's cloak and he says, "Are we there yet?" And the father gives him a zetz and he says, "What are you talking about? We just left." So as the journey is going on the seventh day, father pulls at him and goes, "Are we there yet?" And he says, just almost there. And the kid gets steady. Well, you and I asked the same question you gave me as that. Now you're asking too. Should be good for you if it's good for me. And he said, there's a big difference. You asked right after we left. That's foolish. You knew it was a long journey. The Talmud says, which is written right shortly after the temple is destroyed, don't look to make cheshbonos. Don't write. Don't figure out from biblical prophecies when it's going to happen, because you're just going to be disappointed. But the Ramban wrote in the year 1280. Oh, we feel that we're so close already. Now we can start to ask when are we getting there. So the Malbim noted that, and he said, but now we're really getting close. So I would say what gives us the right today to do this more than ever before is because of Vishavu Banim L'Gvulam. We're returning. Ashrecha Yisrael, to live to see the time where Yirmiyahu's prophecy of Vishavu Banim L'Gvulam is coming true. Where they're coming back. They're returning. Right? I'll leave you for today with that thought. And